Coming up today, CES highlights, internet-connected toasters, Russian hackers, and why you get hungry when you're drunk.
Yay!
You're listening to episode 300 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Jeremy White.
Hello.
A very enthusiastic introduction there. And there's reason to celebrate. We're 300 today. Which is amazing. I don't feel a day
you look
over.
It. You look
yeah,
it.
Yeah, sometimes. So 6 years ago, the Wired.co.uk podcast was born. First episode uploaded on Wednesday, the 24th of November, 2010. 300 episodes later, well, 299 episodes later, here we are. Back then, Nick Clegg was still a thing, WikiLeaks still had something of a reputation, and Apple had just launched the iPad.
Blimey.
Yeah,
okay.
We've come a long way.
A lot has changed in 6 years.
Yeah, and we also had the other slightly less important birthday this week of the iPhone turning 10.
That's true. I'm sorry, I was still stuck on the fact that 6 years ago, no one would ever have thought that Donald Trump was going to be president of the United States as well.
So. Yeah, yep, there we go. And I've been involved in around 100 podcasts, which surprised me. So there we go. What did you learn this week, Matt Burgess?
Have you heard of a website called Pornhub?
Yes.
It's this thing on the
internet. Never heard of it. What are you talking about?
So they've released some figures this week around politicians and who was the most searched for on the website. So who had, and this is an American politician, it's probably too easy actually, 3.6 million search results on Pornhub last year.
Have I already mentioned him?
Does it begin with T and end in rump?
That may have been what they're searching. Okay, yeah. How many did Boris Johnson get? Somebody take a guess.
How much did T Rump get?
Oh, he got 3.6 million. That's in the UK.
Seven? No, wait, as in just seven. Yep.
No, Boris Johnson got 112,000.
Oh my God.
Which was a 1,400% increase compared to last year.
So 112,000 people in the UK are searching for porn footage of Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Or impersonations or something.
And who
those
says
lines.
That the world doesn't go to hell in a handcart, for Christ's sake?
They can do some good data stuff, the guys at Pornhub.
And Theresa May had 383,000.
Oh, that I can understand.
Well, there we go. Thanks, Jeremy. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
Slightly on a more serious note, how much water does it take to create a litre of bottled water?
Well, I mean, the answer's obvious, but it's a bit of a QI question, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, 4 litres.
Jeremy, are you going to take a stab?
Well, I hope I'm wrong, but 3.5?
I'm going to say under a litre, just to be confusing.
It's about 3 litres for the actual water, but including the plastic and everything else, it's 13.6.
Whoa!
You're joking.
Yeah, and it's about 200 litres to make a grande latte. It's like a medium-sized latte.
Drink from the tap.
Yes.
Yep, absolutely.
Don't use plastic.
So a couple of people in the office this week used the term flagging up, flagged up. Someone flagged this up to me. And I thought, well, where does that come from? Someone on Twitter said, oh, maybe it's semaphore. And to some degree it is, flagging things up, flagging things down, flagging things. But the idea of flagging something up also stems from an 1875 American term to designate as someone you will not be served more liquor. So you flag up that they shouldn't be served anymore. I don't know if that means you put a flag on them or a flag near them, but yeah.
Well, we're going to go back to getting drunk later on, aren't we?
Well, let's go on to it right now.
Well, I've actually learned something.
You
this
brought
week.
A fact.
I've
go
actually
on.
Brought a fact with me this week. I found out this week that we spend, apparently, during our lifetimes, we spend a year and a half being in a bad mood. And I told this to my good and worthwhile colleagues. And Ollie Franklin Wallace said, somehow, Jeremy, you've managed to be in a bad mood for a year and a half this year.
So, yep, that sounds about right.
And I sort of fluffed that a bit, but I'm still laughing about it. But anyway, I recognise there's one area in life that I am actually excelling in. I'm actually above the curve.
You're there. Driving the average up.
I think
that's
I
for
am.
Sure. All right, so back to alcoholism or drinking too much. Amelia, when people are drunk, they get hungry, and there's some science as to why.
Yes. So obviously this will come out on Friday, and I assume many people on Friday night will probably be going out for after work drinks and maybe stumbling home with a kebab at 2 o'clock in the morning. And there is a reason for that. Apparently, according to a new study in Nature, the brain cells that promote hunger are activated by alcohol, and this was tested by analysing mice on an alcoholic bender.
So they, such is the way with science, they tested it on mice, as you say. They got the mice drunk, and then what, they analysed their brains?
Yeah, so in your brain you have AGRP neurons, which are responsible for provoking hunger. And they monitored these neurons in mice when they were given ethanol over a three-day period. And also before and after they were given the alcohol, the mice were also treated to a saline solution, which would then serve as their food source. So they monitored the way the neurons were stimulated and how the mice reacted to this and what this means for us when we get drunk.
But we've been aware, and as anyone that's been on a high street in the UK on a Friday or Saturday night will have noticed, that people drink a lot and then eat a lot. So it's not new anecdotally, but it's also not new scientifically.
No, not really. It's been previously shown that ethanol has always been kind of thought to distort the brain hunger signals. But in this experiment showed that, and it showed the specific neurons of the way it affects. And but they tested it by some mice were given the alcohol, and then they had the neuron had they kind of blocked the neuron transmitters to the brain, and those that had the neurons blocked by chemicals meant that they didn't overeat when they were drunk. Right. So it is a specific neuron they found.
Hang on a minute, just back up. They got the mice drunk for 3 days.
They were given ethanol on and off for 3 days because so they assume. The average figures of a man and a woman drinking alcohol in England is a recommended amount for a week is about 14 units. And this is over a 3 day period. So they did, they gave the mice the kind of the more of the average, which is about 18 units over a 3 day period, and tested them, tested the way they were eating and things like that.
I think, James, I think you and I should go out and get drunk for 3 days.
Yes.
And see who can eat the most kebabs at the end of that. And you know,
yeah, I mean, it's less controlled and scientific, but probably...
But more fun.
Yeah, and far worse for mice.
Yeah, and it, I guess it makes you understand a bit more about the way your brain reacts when you're drinking alcohol. I guess this can be a reason why people say, oh, this is why you should do Dry January. Not only are you drinking and that's bad for you, but when you're eating a kebab, which is around 1,000 calories a pop, and
right.
98% of your salt. So I guess it's more of a statistic that can push that.
Does it also mean that it's not my fault if I eat a kebab when I'm pissed?
I mean, well, you make the decision to go drink, so technically it is your fault. But yeah, it is your brain telling you that, hey, you're really hungry now.
See, I knew it. I knew it.
But isn't there also something in that when you drink too much, you lose too much salt, and the reason that you get a hangover is because you've lost a lot of salt?
Yes, so this helps if you eat a kebab, which is about 98% of your daily salt quota.
So there is good to be had here.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah. That's always good to be had.
I'm surprised there's still room at the end of the daily quota to have some more salt.
Yeah, just 2%.
Just 2%, but there you go. Yeah,
that can be the tequila on the salt rim on your tequila shop.
There you go. Something far more serious. Matt Burgess. Russian hackers have been making all kinds of headlines this week. But without getting into that maze, let's look at what they've actually been doing and what they're capable of, because we've had some new reports about that as well.
Yeah, so in the last 6 months leading up to the presidential election in the US, there's been a lot of talk about Russian hackers and accessing data. There was the Podesta emails from the Democratic Party, which were hacked. The Democratic Party itself was hacked, and a lot of data was basically coming out saying, this is why you shouldn't vote for Hillary. And this was attributed to Russian hackers. The US government actually came out and said around the 29th of December that there are around 48 known Russian military and civil intelligence gathering services. So these are groups that are either part of the military or being sponsored in some cases by the Russian government. So being paid, being having resources provided to them.
And they all have fairly strange names. Sourface, Sea Daddy, Crouching Yeti, Cosmic Duke. Are these names given to them by the Americans or names that they
actually... I think I played them online.
Yeah, they sound like Call of Duty handles, don't they?
I think a lot of the names are actually just from that they create themselves or
okay.
related to their work or just applications and coding as well.
But there's two really, really big ones, one of which we might know by the name Fancy Bear. But these are the ones that are doing the vast majority, the very serious work.
Yeah, so these two are called APT-28 and APT-29. The APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat, which I thought I was going to forget, but now I've remembered. And these two groups are basically the most sophisticated. They're the two that got inside the actual political parties in the US, and that's actually what the US government said. And they've been in there, I think ATP-29 have been in their systems since around 2015, the APT-28 have been in there since about 2016. So quite a while, amassing data, then pushing it out through groups like WikiLeaks and other organizations that have got political agendas on some cases. So this week, a new report from a security company called FireEye. They've done a lot of work around APT-28 in the past. They've been studying them, they've been watching them, sort of analyzing the sort of moves and methods and techniques that this group uses, has basically summed up a lot of what they've done and how they worked, which gives us a bit of insight into the sort of things that this group is capable of.
Yeah, and this is coming alongside the report made by the US intelligence services, but this is adding more of a technical layer and a third party to it. So it's not just Russia against the US. This is someone else coming along and saying, well, this is what we've found. And it helps to dispel a myth that a lot of people have from watching maybe Hollywood films or TV shows, that it's a kid, typically a boy, maybe about 15, 16 years old, wearing a hoodie in his bedroom, typing really, really quickly, surrounded by Cheetos. This isn't that. It's a business. It's an office. They have working hours. They come in the morning. It's probably more or less how most people in this country in office jobs work, except their work is to discredit the Democratic Party and its politicians.
Yeah, so an analyst at FireEye, Chris Porter, who I was speaking to, who was involved in a lot of this work, was actually saying pretty much what you've just said there, James, that it is a really organized, business-like, bureaucracy-like environment inside some of these companies. So he said they've got the hackers, obviously, who are accessing this information, but they've got software development teams, they've got teams that work with their media operations and pushing this sort of data and their work out there, and they can do several operations concurrently. So it's quite a big team. He wouldn't actually tell me a number that he thought, or wouldn't even like to speculate a number of how many people that could actually be involved in this, but it was saying it's a really sophisticated, basically organized criminal enterprise
that's state sponsored.
Yeah, that is state sponsored. And he was saying that actually there are very few ways that they actually use their techniques. One of the main ones that they use to get into this information is called spear phishing, where they basically spoof a website or an email address so it looks legitimate. So if I was typing Jeremy White into an email address, they might create one Jeremy.white but have the I as the one, for example, so it looks legitimate. And that's actually one of the ways that they got into the systems, because once you get somebody to change their password thinking that it's wrong, and it basically comes back to their servers, and that is how you get into the systems, then you nab all the data.
So it's something as simple as a zero looks like an O, an L looks like an I, looks like a one, and that can get people in.
Yeah, but they also apparently do a lot of stuff that is a lot more sophisticated. So this guy, Chris, was saying that actually some of the stuff that he's seen them doing is some of the most sophisticated computer network exploitation, also known as hacking, that he's seen anywhere, really.
Wow.
And this is like creating zero-day exploits for services. So they've created them for Windows and a few other basic applications and stuff in the past.
Well, creating's a bit of a so they find them, right? And then they don't tell anyone about them. So governments have control of zero days, but you'd imagine that these groups probably have control of a damn sight more than the governments, because otherwise the governments would be able to stop them from using the zero days because they'd know about them already. So they're finding these innate flaws in popular software that governments don't even know about and exploiting them.
Yes. And
for years.
This is something that you said they can turn around very quickly, so they can actually modify these zero days to be very similar but different, like a slightly different exploit. And they can do that because of the size of their teams. And he said they work like 9 to 5 hours, sort of all work in a Russian programming language, so everybody's basically on the same page. And these are obviously organizations that are paying people and really just structured and organized, yeah. And not like you would expect.
That's so
what they're missing really is, you know, a decent pension plan and a dental plan or something like that. You know, that's what it's almost sounds like.
I'm sure that they've probably got similar things like that. I can't obviously say for definite that they do, but if they've got an organised structure where they have people working in roles and maybe even set hours,
yeah.
They didn't say that explicitly, but I don't think it's a far leap to make.
Then and you'd imagine
could
with
be
the
HR department.
Yeah, absolutely. You can make complaints that you're being asked to hack outside of office hours. And you would imagine that there's huge, huge wins to be made here for individuals. So the salaries, you'd imagine, would be very high. And this is the amount of power that it's been shown that Russian hacking activities can have over foreign elections is remarkable and continues to make headlines in light of what Donald Trump's been accused of this week and the publications in BuzzFeed and CNN. But it's not likely to stop now that perhaps their aim was to get Donald Trump into power. But that doesn't mean that they're now done, much as Trump says that Putin will have to stop this hacking now.
No, as international affairs go and international relations go, they're obviously always ongoing. There's obviously negotiations in different places. And we've got elections coming up in Germany, France, the Netherlands all this year. The Germans already accused Russia of trying to influence their elections and they're monitoring it. I think the British government has launched like an inquiry this week into just general cybersecurity practices in the light of this sort of hacking. And Chris here at this organisation said that he expects to see a lot more cases where the hackers are actually obtaining information and then giving it to third parties to publish in the case that we've done here with a specific motivation. So it's yep. probably going to be a lot more to come.
And that's the really interesting thing about, so you're alluding to WikiLeaks to some degree, who published seemingly some of the information that was obtained by these hackers. WikiLeaks maintained that they have no idea. Well, they say it wasn't handed to them by the Russians, that the Russians had nothing to do with it. But the intelligence reports beg to differ, and it's the amount of intermediaries that seemingly this data is able to pass between, and then it makes it into, some might argue, WikiLeaks is a legitimate news source. It makes it to somewhere where it can be put out and seem like it's not connected to Russia in any way. So the sophistication of the hacking, the computer security, the network analysis, and then of the distribution is incredible, and something that seemingly the Americans weren't prepared for.
No, and I don't think probably anybody is completely prepared for, but it just goes to show that it's not that teenage boy in his bedroom.
Wasn't the Podestra thing, though, wasn't that through an email? They wanted him to change his password. So that was like, it was very simple on the face of it. And I guess just means you should just be really more careful.
Yeah, and in fact, anecdotally, there's been a really, really, really good email scam doing the rounds. I got a couple of people in my inbox that were fooled by them. It looks like the little attachment image that Gmail pulls in of a PDF. So there's the body of the email and then there's an image at the end of it. And it looks like you're just meant to click it to download the PDF. But what it is, it's just a picture. You click on it, it takes you to a shortened URL, and then that starts spamming out and compromising your computer. So it's fooled a lot of people and people that work in the tech business. So there we go. From Russian hackers, make the seamless segue to dogs. Dogs, guys, yes. A study this week showed that the weird, slow, oft high-pitched voice that people put on when talking to their beloved pooches isn't totally pointless.
Come on, give us a bit. Come on. Come on, James.
So, well, give me a dog name.
Poncho.
So it would be something like, come on, Poncho. Come on, Poncho. That kind of thing, right? And you call it like, Poochie Woochie. Yeah?
Poncho.
Just like that. Poncho.
Sorry, just off the top of my bloody head, for Christ's sake. Okay. What? Nigel.
I'm not doing it again. Come on, Nigel. Yeah, that kind of thing. So the study found that it looked at humans and how they interacted with dogs and found that puppies in particular responded better when spoken to in so-called dog-directed speech. So
you have to do the rest of the segment
yes,
like that.
Yes, sounding
James.
A bit like Scooby-Doo. The strange mode of speech alone, they concluded, was not always enough to capture a dog's attention. So things like familiarity of voice and gesturing, particularly in older dogs, was incredibly important. So to test their theory, they got a load of adult volunteers speaking in front of pictures of puppies, adult dogs and old dogs and analysed the nature of their speech. So were they going really high-pitched or were they going like really doggy, that kind of thing, right? And these recordings were then played back to real dogs. It's great, isn't it? Their recordings were then played back to real dogs to assess their reactions to dog-directed speech versus normal speech. Adult dogs seem to ignore dog-directed speech from an unfamiliar person, but if it's from a familiar person and they're waving their arms around, then they'll pay more attention. Whereas a puppy, the second someone starts raising, like they get more high-pitched and more doggy, then the puppy immediately pays attention, regardless of who it is that's speaking. So, there you go.
So is that because puppies aren't cynical enough?
Maybe. They didn't suggest why a difference in age.
When dogs are in distress and they whine, the register goes higher.
Yes.
And so that would be something that they would have to take notice of from a Darwinian point of view. Is that anything to do with it whatsoever?
They didn't speculate on it, so I guess there's more research to be done beyond this. One thing that they did find, and this is a bit of a short story, there's not much more to be said about it, but one thing that they did find that really surprised them was that people used the weird dog voice regardless of how old the dog is. So the researchers postulated before they started doing the research that perhaps people only spoke to puppies in this, because it's kind of how people talk to kids, sort of, right?
Yeah.
That they thought, well, when a dog grows up, you tend to just treat it a bit more like an adult. But their conclusion was that non-speaking animals, most people tend to address them in this strange, slightly infantile, often high-pitched, weird way with lots of, like, poochy-woochy kind of language.
I'd love to have seen someone that's standing at the other end of the room. Nigel, bring me the bone.
And nothing happens.
Nigel, bring me the bone.
And then the bone comes, right? Yeah, just like that. So this is our first podcast of 2017. Ideally, we would have had one last week, but the reason that we didn't was an awful lot of us were in
drunk
wonderful,
for 3 days.
Yeah, drunk for 3 days and eating lots of kebabs. Not me, but Matt Burgess, Jeremy White, and Vicky Williston were all at CES in wonderful, unique, like nowhere on earth, Las Vegas. Matt Burgess, it was your first CES. I want your one line summary of what you thought.
Of Vegas or of the show? Because I'd never been to Vegas before.
Yeah, well, both.
Absolutely, ridiculously, over the top.
That seems fair. And of the show?
I think
the
ditto.
Same.
Yeah, the same. Jeremy, you're a bit of an old hand at this.
I am. I've been many times to CES, many times. And it happens every time. I get very excited as I'm going out there and then I land. And the enormity of the task hits me. And I start to slump.
So we should put this into perspective and also probably explain what it is. This is the Consumer Electronics Show. It happens every January in Las Vegas. It's the world's largest electronics convention.
170,000 people.
Which is a lot.
It's the largest trade show in the world.
And it can only be hosted in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Because Las Vegas has more hotel rooms than any city in the world, and also a whopping great big convention center. So out of those 170,000 people, you were two of them. What were your highlights? Matt, would you like to venture?
So it was my first one, so I was obviously a bit overwhelmed by everything. So I would say
You were a pro. You nailed it. Come on. Nailed it. Sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off your stride there.
Nailed it, mate, nailed it.
Yeah, unlike this segment.
So my highlight, I guess, was actually something that we knew about before CES. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a lot of new product announcements that come throughout it every year. There's loads of just really small incremental announcements from companies. But I actually really liked the Project Alloy Intel's VR headset, mm-hmm. which is an all-in-one combined headset that senses depth and puts real objects in front of you, like a coffee table, into a virtual world, so you don't walk into it, and you can walk around with the virtual reality headset on. And it was one of the first times I think they were actually demoing it and showing journalists how it can be used.
So it's kind of combining Google's Project Tango thing, which is a room scanning tablet, with virtual reality like HTC Vive or HoloLens, which is more augmented reality, right? So it, as you say, you don't walk into the table, but it also means that it can make the virtual world more realistic and more immersive. Right?
Yeah, and you don't. The key thing is that you don't need a computer with it. It's all in the headset.
Right.
So you just put it on. So you could, in theory, walk around an entire building, upstairs, venture through rooms. And so say you had an abandoned office block. That could become a game center. You know, like do you remember... What was it called? Nightmare. Do you remember the old children's program?
Yeah.
Nightmare. They could do things like that. You could walk around, and you could, when you lift your hand up to in front of the visor, your hand suddenly appears in this virtual world, and so it's constantly evaluating where you are and whether you're going to bump into anything and things like that. And you can take things from the real world and then use them in the virtual world as well. So it's a significant leap forward, isn't it?
It is, but they're obviously not making it until they're going to license it out. And actually, they said at the show that it will be a product before... Well, they said they're going to productize, which I assume means it's going to be a product, maybe not on sale, but before the end of the year. So there's a lot of it to come, but there's a lot of weird things there as well, wasn't there, Jeremy?
there was a lot of weird things. I think we've heard the phrase a few times, we've reached peak IoT or peak Internet of Things, and it could have happened. I personally don't think we have. I think it's going to get even stupider. But we did get some amazing things this year. We got the Cat Pad, which was a sci-fi pod that swings open and feeds your cats right away, and can, you know, with the cameras in it as well. You got the things like the Withings brought out a connected hairbrush that got a lot of press. It was like this year's happy fork, if you remember the vibrating fork that stopped you eating so quickly. And then you had the Kinza rectal thermometer, which was let's move swiftly past that.
Yes.
You got the rather wonderful Le Smart Gain. Le Smart Gain is an internet connected walking stick. You got the Smarty Pans, which was an internet connected frying pan. My God, an internet connected frying pan. I'm losing the will to live.
Wait, does it like tell you when your egg's ready?
Oh, well, I don't know. You know, I try not to get too excited about an internet created frying pan.
You'd imagine
would
be one of its.
It probably would. Yeah, and then there was the a wonderful power ray, which was a drone, a fishing drone. So you dropped it in the water and it would find the fish for you and let you know, and even catch them for you, the drone. And then my personal favourite was there was an internet-connected, an IoT bridle for a horse.
Right.
Yes, a bridle for a horse.
So as with a lot of these things, the hairbrush, the bridle, internet-connected sports gadgetry or whatever, it tends to be to discover the optimum way to do things, right? To improve your golf swing, I guess, to improve how you brush your hair, to improve how you ride your horse. Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly that. You know, also recognizing when you're jumping, and also the movement of the horse, how far it goes, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's all sorts of, there's lots of things that it registers.
Analytics.
I'm thinking of testing it.
Yeah.
Not personally.
Someone has to.
But getting it on an
animal. Put it on a horse. And there is as you say, there's something of a fine tradition of this. And Matt Reynolds, who was in the office last week, put together a fun little roundup of some of the dumbest things that people have put chips in recent years. A couple of highlights from that. The Toasteroid, where you can print and design anything onto a slice of toast and send toast messages or toastages to your friends who also have the same device as you. There's the Cube, which is a garbage can, trash can, bin, whatever you want to call it. It has a built-in screen and thermometer, and per its Kickstarter page, alerts can also be set to warn a user if the temperature rises drastically or it does not detect any movement during a user-defined time period. So by that, are we to infer that the bin will tell you if it's on fire, but also alert the emergency services if you don't put anything in it in a few days, which might suggest that you're dead?
Yes. I mean, this is welcome to the wonderful world of the Internet of Things. It really is the case. I mean, this started a while ago. I remember we
no
reviewed...
one actually buys these things.
No, they do. I mean, like this started a while ago when we reviewed the Samsung's internet connected washing machine. And the funny thing about it was is that you only when you use it do you realise that they, you know, they were so convinced, you know, like that. You know, they were so excited that they could do it, and they never actually stopped to think, should we do it? And so why do you want to connect your washing machine to the internet? Why do you need to do that? It's not even a washer dryer, so you can't even switch it to the drying cycle while you're at work. Oh, the washing is done. I'll make it sure it's dry when I get
home.
Which
would be handy.
But, you know, you've got to physically be there. So there's actually no benefit whatsoever from having this particular white goods device to be connected to the internet, but it is nonetheless.
Does it have a live IP camera so you can watch your smalls on the spin cycle?
No. Not even joys like that are available to you. However, basically, there's going to be a lot of this, a lot of companies figuring out, you know, oh, we can do this, let's do it and let's see if it sticks. It's basically throwing crap against the wall and see what sticks. And some of it's really good and some of it's not. And some of it's entertaining and some of it's not. Some of it's genius, you know.
So we should say at CES there are literally village-sized halls of this
stuff. Just of this stuff, exactly. Yeah. It's bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. There's, you know, it's not just that, though. I mean, there's halls on wearables. There's halls, you know, there's the main halls where you've got, you know, all the established tech giants showing off their new stuff. The LG's W television, which was so thin that it looks like almost like a poster stuck to the stuck to your wall and held on by magnets. It's so light because it's so thin. I mean, that is truly amazing. Bloody difficult to illustrate in the magazine or online.
Yes.
You've really got to actually see that for yourself, because you're talking about something that's, oh, it's really thin. And it's like, so, okay, well, how do we illustrate that? Oh, God. A very thin line, exactly. But, you know, that was very cool. You've got loads of other things happening. One of the main themes this year, definitely there was loads more on the autonomous driving world, wasn't there? You saw a few of these, didn't you, Matt?
Yeah, I saw a few of them around loads of companies, and companies that you weren't expecting necessarily to be developing driving technology. So Bosch were involved, Panasonic were involved, a few other companies as well. But most of them were sort of looking at concepts and ways that cars can talk to each other and not completely autonomous driving systems, whereas BMW and Intel, I think it was, launched some cars or were demonstrating some cars.
Yeah, that's right. They were. We had a reasonably exclusive go in there, BMW's latest iteration of their autonomous driving vehicle, the co-piloted vehicle. And it was a brand new 5 Series. That was nice to actually, because I haven't seen the new 5 Series yet. It's a brand new 5 Series, and we went out onto the motorway outside of Vegas and just drove up and down it using just the car. Actually, we've got a nice video going up on the site if anyone wants to see this. But basically, it's using the existing technology within the car, lane assist, lane control, and also cruise control. But it's also referring that to a computer in the back with a high definition maps on it, so it can actually refer to that as well. And also, you know, the later versions of obviously will include LiDAR and stuff like that. But so they're just showing that BMW are just showing that we're in this particular game with Intel, what they also asked, at the show, hey, any other of our competitors would like to come and join us in developing this? We'll all develop this together. Probably knowing that not many will, because Audi have already got their very well established program. So has obviously Tesla. So is Mercedes-Benz. You know, they're all working on it themselves. But it was nice for them to actually, what is normally the incredibly secretive world of the automotive business, to actually turn around and say, hey, let's all work together and see if we can get this absolutely right and standardized so it can actually be adopted quicker across the board as well.
Right. And this is the big, big unanswered questions about self-driving cars is standardization. How are these cars going to talk to each other? At the moment, it doesn't matter that the technology in my Ford, I mean, I can't drive, but theoretically in my Ford, can't talk to the technology in Matt Burgess's Renault.
Mm.
But when they're driving themselves, that will be absolutely crucial. At the moment, there's so much competition to become this platform operator, which you'd imagine Google would love to be, that it's quite worrying comes to big hunking chunks of metal.
Well, at the moment, if you consider it though, at the moment all the cars are driving themselves singularly anyway. You are, and no one is talking to each other. So they all consider it to just be like that, but computers driving the cars, and so it's exactly like it is right now. But the tremendous advantages of having the cars be able to speak to each other is obviously they can chain. So, that would be tremendously useful too. And now, obviously, I'm sure they will make that happen. But right now, they're just concerned on developing their own systems so they can do that. We've seen some really interesting internet footage of, you know, a Tesla car avoiding a crash before the driver, they're still in charge of the vehicle, hadn't even noticed that a crash was about to happen, and the car had already slammed on the brakes, and one or two seconds later the crash happened in front of them. And so these systems are already tremendously sophisticated, and it is one of those cases where the legislation and the legal framework is not actually in place, and it's one of those ones where the technology is actually far more advanced than that. So they are capable of doing this already, and we're just waiting for the bureaucracy and the civil service in various jurisdictions to catch up and let us do it.
And of course, all the car companies and technology companies will argue that the more of these smart, intelligent, these augmented cars, the more of them that you have on the road, the better, because they're more predictable than humans.
Less accidents, you know, far quicker reactions. There's plenty of arguments for it. I mean, of course they're going to have accidents. You know, you cannot have, you know, computers, you know, however sophisticated, you know, in such proximity, you know, driving at very high speeds, in those massive numbers without something happening. Of course it will happen. It'll be about, you know, how much safer will it be? And also, what's interesting is how they're going to teach these vehicles. I'm going off on one a bit here, but how they will teach these vehicles to make moral judgments. I mean, at the moment, if you're in a terrible situation where you're about to have an accident and you're going to hit one car out of two, you know you're going to see that you can't, like it's a no-win scenario. You are going to hit a vehicle, but what do you do? If you're, you know, a human being will make some sort of subjective evaluation, you know, do I hit the car with the old lady in it or do I hit the car with the young mother and the child in it? You know, that sort of thing. And you go like, oh my God, what do I do? I'm going to hit one of them. What will a computer do in that situation? You know, when with emotion completely removed from that equation. And this is what's interesting. How they will, what they will it, will it hit both?
You know, just to be fair.
Well, just because it doesn't know what, because it will see right. No advantage from having one or the other. You know, of course it won't, but something like that. But it's those questions that I'm particularly interested in.
And why standardisation, much as it sounds boring, is absolutely key. Because you can't have a Toyota that's more likely to kill a young mother versus a Mercedes that's more likely to kill an old woman or whatever.
But these cars won't kill anybody. We should put that out there. It's, you know, you're in charge of the vehicle, and hopefully no one, of course, will suffer any accidents after this comes out. It would be wonderful to live in a world where there would be no more fatalities on the road, but it's probably not going to be the case. However, there are, you know, significant philosophical questions that go along with this area of technology. And that is a genuinely interesting area that needs to be, you know, looked into further.
We've gone off on a bit of a tangent away from CES. Was there... Yes, Matt Burgess.
I put my hand up then.
Even though I'm looking right at you. Go on.
There was one other thing that I think that was actually quite interesting from CES that was, I guess, is sort of related to the intelligence and artificial intelligence, exactly. And that was from Amazon. And that was Alexa, personal assistant. I don't think Amazon was actually showing off anything really big at the show, and they definitely didn't announce anything. They're probably there behind closed doors and speaking to people. But Alexa, the personal assistant, the AI bot, which is in the Echo Home speaker, was actually rolled out to a number of different products. So I think it was put into a car from Ford, potentially. Yeah. It was in a Hoover from Samsung. I think it's in a fridge as well. But basically, that's come from Amazon saying, we're going to sort of open source, or at least let developers access the code behind this, it can be put into other products.
It was like some sort of badge of honor for the products companies, wasn't it? So like, oh, and this is also compatible with Alexa. You know, like, you know, it was a year where lots of companies wanted to have the Alexa badge.
You know that your technology is doing pretty well when you don't even have to be at CES to be at CES. Like Apple. Apple has never been, I don't think, at CES, but is always one of the biggest stories of the show by the sheer number of peripherals or accessories or whatever it may be. So Alexa is kind of broken through in a similar way.
Yeah, and I think there's going to be plenty more products released this year that say one of their main key points is saying we have Alexa in this and it will work with your other Alexa products and stuff like that. So good work from Amazon, I guess, in terms of beating Google and people to not just the market for this already, but actually making their code available to other people to develop with and use in their own products.
So get ready to talk to your incredibly expensive new Hoover, fridge, washing machine, toaster, horse bridle, rectal thermometer.
Well, Lord knows you need to be able to do more with Alexa anyway.
It's a good point.
If I would be very much, you know, appreciative if I could speak to my rectal thermometer using Alexa, yes.
It's the future, and I don't want it to happen. All right.
It's grim.
We'll leave it at that then. Thanks very much, and we'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. 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 Goodbye.